Hi everyone, Jason here. On May the 14th, Stephen and myself will be appearing with the one and only Mark Lewison at the Pavilion Theatre in Dunleary, Dublin. We're going to be celebrating 60 years of A Hard Day's Night, and we would love you to join us. For tickets, go to paviliontheatre.ie or nothingisrealpod.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Welcome to Nothing Is Real, a podcast about the Beatles. Everybody thinks they know the Beatles, but how much do we really know? My name's Jason Carty.
My name's Stephen Cockcroft.
And we're live on tape from Dublin and Belfast. In the never-ending discussion about the best Beatles album, there's been a dark horse that some people have been putting at the top of their list in recent years. A Hard Day's Night, released on the 10th July 1964, as the third Beatles album. 30 minutes long, and the only Beatles album made up entirely of Lennon and McCartney songs, with no Ringo tune. It is the album and not the film that we are going to talk about today. But they are hard to separate because one kind of exists without the other. It can't really happen, can it, Stephen?
It can't. And, you know, it really starts with the film and leads into the album. Is it their best album? I was talking to somebody on Twitter and they said it does what it does better than Abbey Road does what it does. I pondered that, and that was from I kind of thought, I kind of see what they mean. You know, I mean, it's a summation of where they are, and it's a launching pad for the peak Beatlemania.
I think the thing that does set it apart is the fact that it's all Lennon and McCartney originals. And, you know, you look at that first batch of albums, let's say pre-Rubber Soul, it's the only one of those albums that's all Lennon and McCartney. And, you know, that's kind of audacious and that sets it apart because I think there's a feeling amongst fans that the two subsequent albums, you know, Beatles for Sale and Help, it's like, oh, they shouldn't have cover versions on them.
Yeah, there's a couple of good podcasts on Beatles for Sale and Help albums. And
yeah, I think people should check those out.
I think that's right. The idea that both of those albums are a little bit of a step back simply because they're reverting back to rock and roll covers. This is the album, I think, that signaled to the wider world and probably the sort of more serious music critics that they were capable of more than just writing catchy singles. You know, you've got a greater depth to the lyrics coming in. You've got, you know, use of the studio techniques coming in. Plus, as you say, they're writing all the material.
Yeah, and it really, you know, maybe that mightn't have been totally apparent in July 1964 when it came out, but it's certainly very apparent when you kind of look at the arc of their album releases. But when we get to this point of which came first, the album or the film, it's, you know, you say the film, but the film happened because somebody wanted an album. What exactly is the order of events?
Well, what happens here is that United Artists, this is in October 63, United Artists decide they would like to get in on the Beatles action. And primarily what they're interested in is a soundtrack album. You know, the film, they're not looking to make a great artistic statement. They're not thinking the film is going to have a long life or going to make them the money. The money is going to come off the soundtrack album. The interesting thing is that this goes back to October 63. So at a time when the Beatles really are not making any impact, haven't made any impact in the States.
It's an American push that's trying to get this made. Yeah. And, you know, in British rock and roll at the time, there was an indigenous kind of movie scene. You know, you have your Cliff Richard films, for instance. So it's not beyond the realm of
Bongo.
Yes, which keeps popping up on late night TV. But it's, you know, it's not unimaginable that, you know, one of these British movie companies who were very prevalent at the time could have knocked off a Beatles film. But the, you know, the preemptive move is coming from, as you say, United Artists, which is based in America. And their notion is to knock off something kind of cheap and exploitative in order to undercut the album rights and kind of get the album rights on, get an album onto United Artists.
Exactly, exactly. Yes, they're not interested in making great art here. It's just going to be another cheap exploitation movie. Get the album out. It must have appealed to Epstein because of the American connection. You know, they're still at this stage, they're trying to break America. Capitol aren't releasing the singles. We've touched on this in previous episodes. So you can see this as part of Epstein's strategy. There's an American film company comes knocking at the door. You know, we can perhaps cover in another episode Epstein's negotiations around the film and that sort of thing. He, I think, does see this as part of his armory in trying to get Capitol on board and trying to break America.
Yeah, I mean, you kind of, you know, you dance to with whoever asks you. And at that back end of 63, all he wants to get is, you know, some kind of foothold in America and the promise of an album out. Because, you know, the labels that had taken the, you know, once Capitol had first refusal, the labels that have been putting out Beatles singles, they weren't the biggest labels in the world. No. And here's United Artists saying, yeah, we don't just want a single, we want an album. But they weren't in the market for making a movie, the Beatles themselves. They didn't really want to make a movie.
No, I think there was a certain hesitancy on their part. You know, they knew they weren't actors. This wasn't playing to their strengths. Their sense was, you know, we're doing what we're doing and we're doing it very well and it's being successful. Why do we need to sort of stick our head above the parapet and, you know, potentially leave ourselves open to criticism? They would have been very conscious, I suppose, of the Elvis pattern of that diminishing return and the undermining of his credibility.
And that sort of deal is hammered out in October 63. And as we've talked on the Ed Sullivan episode, that, you know, Brian kind of uses it as leverage to, you know, open more doors in America. But, you know, you start thinking of that timeline, you know, the album that comes out at the end of 63 is with the Beatles. And that's an album that comes together quite quickly. And so the Beatles obviously know at that point, oh, our next job is we've got a movie full of songs to do. That must be something that's put to them in October, November 63. We don't really know specifically the date when they found out they'd be making a movie, but it must be around that time.
It must be just as maybe just before With the Beatles comes out. You know, if they were talking October, November, it's November 22nd is when With the Beatles comes out. So by that stage, they know that there's going to be another single required. There's going to be a sort of a concert tour that they're doing in France, plus immediately following that up, they're going to have to record a soundtrack, plus they're going to have to go straight into filming the movie. And in the interim, they're going to have to find, you know, get the script written. Yeah. They were very clear. There's an interview where I think it's John is saying, you know, we did not want this just to be us wandering around from one TV studio to another saying hello to Al McCogan or, you know, Helen Shapiro and these very kind of stilted setup. You know, they knew they didn't want that.
And the other angle of this that I've all wondered about is at what point did Parlophone, were they told as well that, okay, you know, the album that comes out following With the Beatles, you know, if we're on two albums a year, as was their original deal, that album number three, the first half of 64 album, was going to be a soundtrack. Like, you could argue they could have had a problem with that because they could have said, well, why would we advertise a film that we've got no financial, stake in?
Well, they wouldn't have had a stake in the film, but I suppose they know by this stage the album is going to sell.
Yeah.
So even if the film is a flop, Parlophone have the album in the UK. So they're going to make money off the back of the album. And as I say, where we started from is United Artists are coming from the point of view is that it's the album that's going to make them money, not the film.
Yeah. So, you know, we will do a podcast someday about that focuses on the film itself, but we want to look at the album. And as we said, it's 13, not 14 songs, all original Lennon and McCartney tracks, which is impressive. And, you know, there was obviously part of the demand or part of the contract or the demand from UA was that the original songs would all be Lennon and McCartney originals.
Yes, Yes.
So that would have been a driver for that. But even still, they could have done, you know, one side of Lennon and McCartney originals for the film and then just done a B-side of covers and so bits and pieces. So let's look at the timeline of recording the album. So, you know, the Beatles are having a busy enough time as things are exploding around them at the end of 63 and the start of 64. But even though they're busy, they also have, you know, two kind of what you might say static commitments. They spend Christmas in London doing the first Beatles Christmas show. Yeah. And then after Christmas, you know, they have one performance on Sunday night at the London Palladium on January the 12th, which is perhaps not really as remembered as the 1963 performance.
No, this is a sort of big cabaret family gather around the television moment on a Sunday night. You know, there's the big variety show. So, I mean, it's quite a thing that sort of famously have this revolving carousel at the end when all the acts join. I think famously the Stones then refused to jump onto the revolving carousel when they were doing it.
But the Beatles are playing the Rolling Stones.
The Beatles are playing the game.
So they go on Sunday at the Palladium. Curiously, their fee has quadrupled to £1,000 from when they were on it just 4 months or 3 months earlier. The other interesting fact about that performance is the comedian Dave Allen was on the bill, and he next shared a bill with John Lennon in 1975 on the Salute to Lou Grade.
Oh, the Lou Grade, yeah.
Yeah, so Dave Allen was there as well. But then what they spend the next couple of weeks doing is in France. They have a warm-up gig in Versailles, and then from January the 16th, 1964 to February the 4th, 1964, they are playing their residency at the Olympia Theatre in Paris. And this is famously right at the start of that residency is where they get the news that I Want to Hold Your Hand is number one in America. And there you have those pictures of them jumping up and down with pillows and all the rest. And, you know, it's a bit of an eye of the storm kind of situation. They've got this 3 week residency in this one city. They're not in the van going up and down a freezing cold UK. And they're kind of sitting on the knowledge for the 3 weeks that they are selling. They're the biggest selling act in Capitol Records history in the States.
Yes. I mean, one of the things that is interesting about this entire enterprise is how the songs are written and where the songs are written. Hmm. So, you know, up to this point, as you say, they were writing songs in Paul's front room or they're in hotel rooms doing this eyeball to eyeball notion or on a bus tootling up, I was going to say the motorway, but there weren't even any motorways. But here they're working very much to a deadline. They're also working to a script, if you like, so that on occasion throughout this period, they will be told, we need a song for this or we need a song for that. You know, we need a fast song, we need a slow song. So they're writing as they're touring, as they're in America, as they're in Paris, even when they're on holiday, they're writing over this period to a deadline.
So they have kind of three, you know, this we kind of figure there's about three main areas where they're writing songs in that, you know, first half of 63, which is, you know, while they are in Paris, while they are in New York City, and some of the later songs come out in May while they are on holidays. Because the breadth of the recording for the Hard Day's Night album, you know, the earliest recording is on January the 29th and the last recording is on June the 1st, although January the 29th, as we'll discuss in a second, isn't particularly in-depth. It's really the end of February when most of the songs get recorded. But they are on this residency in Paris, as we said, from January 16th to February the 4th. They're earmarked to go into the studio in Paris, which outside of their Hamburg days is their only kind of non-UK recording session, isn't it?
Yes, that's right. That's right.
So they're due to go in on the January the 29th. Now, what I find interesting is the night before, January the 28th, John and George, they take a quick jolly over to London. And for the first time, they meet Phil Spector.
A momentous date.
A momentous date. More pleasingly, they met Ronnie Spector as well, who's someone who still speaks very fondly of the Beatles.
I was going to say, I would guess most of John and George were probably more excited to meet Ronnie Spector than Phil Spector.
Yes, and why wouldn't they? She's fantastic. She played Dublin about 2 years ago, and she was full of stories of the Beatles and all sorts of things. She's just an absolute treasure. But on January the 29th, in the midst of this Paris residency, they are summoned to the studio. And there's initially a bit of a Beatles strike because they don't want to go there for the primary reason that they're supposed to go there.
Yes, they're supposed to be recording German versions of I Want to Hold Your Hand and She Loves You, and they really don't want to do this. And I think we touched on this in the I Want to Hold Your Hand episode way back in season whatever that was, that, you know, they George Martin has to sort of almost physically drag them to the studio. So they get those two songs out of the way and they have, you know, they have an hour left.
And Beatles being Beatles, what do you do when there's an hour left? You try and use it, basically. So it's at this free time at the end of a session in Paris that they trot out Can't Buy Me Love, which is really a Paul number.
It is. It is. I mean, John, at one point, he was sort of saying, well, it was John and Paul wrote that, but mainly Paul. But by 1980, he's saying, no, that's Paul completely. Maybe he had something to do with the chorus. So, yeah, this is absolutely a Paul song.
And what other songs do they have in the tank? Because what we'll notice throughout all of this period is it's not like there's a deep well that they are pulling out songs from. There are songs that are being written right. They're being pinned right to their collar to try and get stuff in studio. And we start to see as we roll this out how songs are coming in and they're about 70% formed and they're really just being finalized and written on the spot. So there's one other song in the tank at this point, isn't there?
Is this Paul's fabulous creation, One and One is Two?
A missing Beatles gem, Stephen, is it?
It's a missing Beatles classic. Yes, this is odd. So have you heard the demo of One and One is Two?
I can't say I have, no. No, I haven't.
You're not missing much. Just to give you an idea of just how good this song is, it was turned down by Billy J. Kramer. they offered it to him, and supposedly John said that if Kramer recorded the song, that would be the end of his career. And in 1980, John was saying that's another of Paul's bad attempts at writing a song. So then it was turned down by Kramer. They offered it to the Foremost, who already they're sort of a Liverpool close harmony group. They'd recorded a couple of Beatles songs by that stage, Hello Little Girl being one of them. They turned it down as well.
Wow. When the Foremost turn you down.
When the Foremost turned you down. So Brian O'Hara, who was their lead guitarist, said he remembers, so, you know, Paul came into the studio and he played bass, but there just wasn't any meat in the song. So Paul is really, you know, Paul's really pushing this. So then it made its way to a group I'm sure you'll have heard of, The Strangers with Mike Shannon.
Oh, Mike Shannon and The Strangers. No.
Yes. Mike Shannon. No, again, this is an All Music review says they had the honor or misfortune of covering the most obscure Lennon-McCartney song that was given away in the 60s and not recorded by the Beatles. So it doesn't seem to have charted anywhere that I can find. Maybe somebody can correct us on that. There have been a couple of reissues, one in Sweden. They were big in Sweden.
it's interesting that, you know, even in 1980, John is still remembering it as Paul's bad attempt at writing the song, as you say.
Never forgive, never forget.
You know? He's in mind like a steel trap, but, you know, there's kind of a recurring thing at the end of 64, I think, or at the end of 63 into 64, where Paul is still trying to unlock what songwriting is. And he's on this kind of seesaw of writing horrifically generic stuff, but then very quickly realizing what works.
Well, the thing is that he's still pushing this song. That's the interesting thing to me as well. So it's there's a sense at this time, and clearly Paul has bought into this, that that you know, if it's a Lennon and McCartney song, it's going to be great, or at least if it's not great, at least it's going to sell. And this seems to be the one that sort of bucks that trend. You can pick it up. There's a good compilation called The Songs Lennon and McCartney Gave Away. It's about 20 songs the Beatles didn't record. But you know, so on the one hand, he's writing this, and on the other hand, he just casually knocks off Can't Buy Me Love.
Yeah, but he does that. Like, you know, he hangs on to songs like, you know, Hope for the Future or something like that, and says, here we go, best song ever. And like, really?
This is, yeah, yeah.
But you know, it's a wonder they didn't try and do a, you know, a, something with Jeff Lynne in 95 with that, you know, they didn't try and resurrect One and One is Two.
There's still time.
Get Jeff on the phone. But what they do, you know, the other song that Paul has, of course, is, as we said, Can't Buy Me Love. And he's sort of describes it in later years as saying, you know, he's trying to write a, you know, bluesy mode song, you know, all about material possessions, you know, they can't buy what I want. And he sort of describes it as a very hooky song later on. And they do about, I think, four takes in Paris. One of them is on Anthology One. And it's there, but it's not quite there. It still doesn't have kind of hit single sprinkle on it.
No, you can feel them sort of moving towards the finished version. And George Martin has a lot to do with this because he's arranging it and he's sort of saying, well, you know, you should move the chorus and you should do this and you should do that. And it's a very collaborative effort. And this, I think, sees the start of the move towards working things out in the studio. So the first two albums, they're pretty much coming and saying, look, we hear the songs and there's sort of minor adjustments, but we'll see across the course of Hard Day's Night that there's much more arranging going on. So they're coming to the studio with ideas and then they're tinkering with them.
It is curious that, you know, they're based in Paris for 3 weeks, and I know they're busy and they're working, but that they didn't think of squeezing in any other studio time, you know, in some of their downtime. But, you know, they were obviously writing and collecting experiences. But the big thing that happens next is what we've talked about in our other episodes, that they go to America. So they wrap up their Paris engagement on February the 4th, and February the 7th to the 21st is the big US invasion, which we talked about in our Ed Sullivan episode. And then they come back to London. They have one more television appearance on Big Night Out, which is on February the 23rd. So they're on the UK TV live while a pre-record third appearance on Ed Sullivan is going out in the UK. And then it's back into the studio. And it's this glut of work at the end of February 64, because they've got a few days before the filming starts. This is where they put up the pressure to themselves and churn out an incredible collection of songs.
Yes, there's a run here over a sort of 5-6 day period, which is really phenomenal. You know, when you think about it, that when you think that they're turning out songs for an album that people are saying, nah, you know, this could be their best album ever. This is certainly in the top kind of maybe three albums they ever produced, and yet it's being recorded under intense pressure.
Yeah, which is something that we see again and again, up to you know how few sessions it took to get Rubber Soul on tape. So they get back into the studio. They are due to begin filming on March the 2nd, 1964. So they go into the studio on February the 25th, which is also George's birthday, which is nice. Yeah. And not taking a day off. And the first thing they do is they get to work on Can't Buy Me Love, because at this point, you know, they need a single, and Can't Buy Me Love is the single. The thing that's a bit uncertain, we might come back to this later on, is whether Can't Buy Me Love from the get-go was supposed to be in the film or not.
Do you know? My sense is that it wasn't intended to be in the film.
It does seem to be, yeah, because they were earmarking other songs potentially for the Can't Buy Me Love sequence. So
yes,
it's not a given at this point that Can't Buy Me Love is necessarily going to be a, you know, in the movie. You know, there's always a need for the next single in the Beatle universe. So it takes a little while for, as you say, there's a bit of organization by George Martin and arranging to try and get the initial range of overdubs done to finish off Can't Buy Me Love. There's a couple of question marks that hang over some aspects of Can't Buy Me Love, isn't there?
Yes, this is a really kind of fascinating little song if you start to deconstruct it. So the first thing is the guitar solo. So if you listen to the guitar solo, it's odd. And well, look, we had this take four done in Paris. We brought that back. We then started to overdub a new guitar solo, but you can still hear the original guitar solo underneath. So he's quite clear that he's sort of playing over the original guitar solo, and they hadn't quite erased it. But it's a very striking sound they get. And he seems to be suggesting this is obviously by accident that it comes up with that. But I always think the guitar solo there, the sound of the guitar solo, is one of the most striking things about the song.
And Paul does some vocal double tracking, and Ringo's kind of adding some cymbals on top. There is this slight technical, as you say, like a technical discrepancy between the tapes that Abbey Road get back from Paris.
Yeah.
The mixing session, if we jump forward to that for a second, that happens later in March without the Beatles there. And there's another kind of interesting fact.
This is your pub quiz question, which is who plays the drums on Can't Buy Me Love?
And you think, obviously Ringo Starr, Stephen. He was the drummer in the Beatles.
Obviously Ringo, because he was there. So Mark Lewisohn mentions this in his sessions book, and he describes a sort of a wrinkle in the tape. So there's a little bit of a dropout there, and that they need to fix. But of course, the Beatles aren't available. They're sort of off touring and filming. So they need to fix this. So Jeff Emmerich's book clarifies this. Lewisohn talks about another drummer, but Jeff Emmerich's book shed some light on that, and he describes that George Martin and Norman Smith decided that took it upon themselves to just fix it. So Norman Smith goes down into the studio and overdubs a drum part to fix this kind of dropout in sound caused by a wrinkle in the tape. And Emmerich suggests even possibly the Beatles don't notice or don't know that this
happened.
This ever happened.
So that's only a small segment of the song.
It's only a little tiny bit in the middle where there's been some kind of a crease or something in the tape that has caused this dropout. And they're working on magnetic tape, and they just fix it very, very discreetly. But that's the pub quiz question, the tiebreak question. If I'm ever hosting a quiz, that will be the question.
So Norman Smith is on that. So yeah, nowadays you just copy and paste a little bit of drums from one bit to the other. So you're saying that Norman Smith, that when he eventually got to number one, that was his second number one that he'd been on. Is that right?
That was his second number one. That was his second number one.
people need to know that. If we just kind of stay on Can't Buy Me Love for a second, it's a song obviously that, gets earmarked as the next single. And, there's a myriad of versions of Can't Buy Me Love out there. It's a song that sticks with them for a while. And it's the first new Beatles single to come out after they've conquered America. So it does have all eyes are on it. And it slips into their live set. They play it, don't they, at the Hollywood Bowl and, on a myriad. There's like a total commercial television blitz of performances.
Yes. And, this becomes a staple of their live show. And as you say, Paul still plays it from time to time. And I saw him play it in 1989. And in my head, this is the first time I saw a Beatle play a Beatles song. But when I look at the set list,
there were
at least two or three others. It was the 13th song that he played in that set. And prior to that, he played Got to Get You Into My Life and Fool on the Hill. But the one that sticks with me as being, oh my God, that's a Beatle, was Can't Buy Me Love.
Yeah. I mean, that's the New World Tour after Flowers in the Dirt in 89. So you're probably dazzled by the Figure of Eight opening track, which is...
What I remember is there was a fantastic Dick Lester directed this kind of movie montage, 30-40 minute movie that we got to see, and you sort of saw all these great clips and performances, and in the opening track when Paul hit the stage was Figure of Eight, and it was really anticlimactic after being dazzled by this kind of movie highlights. That was bad. That was bad. bad planning.
It was not. I mean, I'm quite fond of the Figure of Eight, the track, but it's not a concert opener. It's not exactly one that's.
It's not a concert opener. No.
People up on their feet. And the other good version of Can't Buy Me Love is one that we touched upon briefly in the Ed Sullivan episode. Is he revisits it in the Ed Sullivan Theatre at the start of '93. He has this countrified redo of it. So obviously it's a song that he wrote. It's a song that he's fond of. And, it's a song that's very important. But again, they're working fast. It's this February the 25th. They actually have four songs that they're working on that day. And Can't Buy Me Love is just the start of a very busy day. And when every single has an A-side, a single also needs a B-side. So you take a break to flip over your single. So we shall take a break right now, and we'll talk to you about the B-side after this.
End of part one. Intermission.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
End of intermission, part two.
Welcome back. So the B-side of Can't Buy Me Love is You Can't Do That. And that is the next song that they tackle on February the 25th. And this is originally tagged as also being for the film. They have this down to be done.
Yes. Yes, this is very much a film song, but then it was cut at the last minute. And, you know, it was filmed, there's a sequence, but it's a shame. I love that. This is a great song. This is an absolutely fantastic song.
This is an absolutely fantastic song. And, you know, in the resulting album, it's kind of tucked away at the end. But it's a track that, particularly in the mono version, it just kicks. It absolutely, it's so alive.
And you can see, but you can see that this would not be a good A side. It's almost too kind of hard, too rocky a track. It's quite a step away from the style of song that they've been doing, particularly for singles.
And you know, Paul has the A side with "Can't Buy Me Love," so you know it seems reasonable that John brings along a B side. Overall, it seems to me that you know "Hard Day's Night," the album, is a John album. Would you say
it's very Lennon heavy? I mean, I think he has seven lead vocals on this. George has one. There's two where it's Paul and John, and then three or four by Paul. So it's very Lennon heavy.
Yeah, and you know, You Can't Do That is one of those songs where you just feel Lennon's personality coming through. And as you say, there is a filmed section. For You Can't Do That from the theatre performance in A Hard Day's Night. But it was probably cut because Phil Collins was in the audience. And once again, the spectre of Phil Collins hovers over all of us.
You think if he was playing bad percussion on the back of a seat in the in the audience.
He should have leapt up to do the cowbell on You Can't Do That.
He should have. The cowbell bell is interesting because John talked about this being his Wilson Pickett style song, you know, back in 1980, he talks about this, but I think it's Mark Lewisohn makes the point that Wilson Pickett had not released any song like this by the time You Can't Do That comes out. You know, he Wilson Pickett was more known at that stage for sort of ballads, this kind of R&B ballads, and the songs that we think of, you know, In the Midnight Hour and That's Everything, didn't come out until after this. So he's either misremembering or reconstructing something after the fact.
And is it one of those songs, particularly when you look at it lyrically, is he kind of writing in this idiom of, you know, man, woman, kind of slightly soulish idiom? Or, you know, you could also say, you know, there's potentially something autobiographical going on here.
Yeah, I think this is one of the things that starts creeping in around this time, is this sort of lyrical sophistication of some of these songs. You know, we still have reference to diamond rings and that type of thing, but certainly this Paul in many years from now does allude to this and says, you know, that might have been based on real experiences or arguments with Cynthia or whatever. And he said, oh, you know, we didn't really put that slant on it until later. George mentions this song as having been written in Miami. Okay. So, you know, there's all of those things coming into play. Is he writing about his jealousy? Is he writing about himself? I think the lyrics become more sophisticated around this time.
And, you know, with 21st century eyes, you could argue that some of this jealousy is perhaps not very kind, misogynistic, maybe. It's a bit possessive, yeah. Obsessive. And if you are looking at it with a kind of, is this, how personal is this lyric? You know, it does kind of shoot through to kind of jealous guy, I think, almost, is a kind of lyric that flips back on what You Can't Do That is about.
Yeah, I think so. And I suppose that's interesting to contrast his own self-awareness between You Can't Do That to the kind of more self-aware lyric in Jealous Guy. Good point. Good point.
Finally, I make a good point. 50-something episodes in.
You always make good points.
There you go. Scrounging for pumpkins. Here we go. So they record 5 full takes and... Paul's playing the cowbell, Ringo's playing bongos, John's double tracking his vocals, but they also successful young pop stars, they've got loads of kind of new gear, don't they?
Yeah. So this is John has his Rickenbacker, George has got his 12 string Rickenbacker. This is Ringo's onto his second Ludwig drum kit. Paul's Hofner bass, they'd use that on I Wanna Hold Your Hand. So Paul is the only one that doesn't really have new toys to play with. But this is a change in sound and new equipment coming in at this stage.
And, I said 4 full takes, one of which, take 6, is heard on Anthology 1. Now, I have to recall, when I watched the first episode of Anthology 1 and that was used over the end credits, it really struck out because I hadn't really totally absorbed the Anthology 1 album at the time. And I was like, that's different. That's interesting. That's a great take, that Anthology take 6. And there's also an unused George Martin piano overdub. Man, he loves nipping in and doing a bit of piano, doesn't he, George, behind our backs?
Yeah, the boys aren't here. I'm just going to slow that tape down.
I'm going to throw a piano on top.
He's like Jules Holland. You know, nothing can be improved by a bit of piano. This has got to be a take that's going to come out. So when we get the A Hard Day's Night deluxe box set, we get this take.
So that is their B-side, You Can't Do That. As we said, it was filmed for A Hard Day's Night. They also briefly do a pass through it during the Get Back, Let It Be month of January 69.
Yeah, they touch on everything in January 69.
They do.
But yeah, it's a song that they played live in the studio for the takes. You know, so they're pretty much recording the basic track here live. So I suppose in 69, this is something they can... they can go back to that.
And it also pops up on the Live the Hollywood Bowl / 8 Days a Week releases as well. There's versions, live versions of it there. But February the 25th continues apace. The next song that they put down is And I Love Her.
This is the big one.
This is the big song. So Paul, this is, so we said earlier that Paul is kind of figuring out how to write songs. And I Love Her is essentially brought in as a solo Paul composition. And for a guy who's figuring it out, he must have realized when he wrote this, he had figured something out.
Yes. Because if you think about the songs that he's been writing, the songs that he writes on his own up to this point are kind of rock songs. They're kind of, I Saw Her Standing There, Can't Buy Me Love. You'd mentioned All My Loving. That's a Paul song, a solo song. But again, it's a kind of up-tempo, catchy, hook-laden, could easily have been a single. This is something different. This is really his first, I suppose, big ballad. They've done song ballads before, Till There Was You, but this is an original song. This is his first, I suppose, big signature ballad. This is what he becomes known for.
Well, that's the thing. You think of Paul McCartney, you think romantic-y, ballady type songs, amongst other things. He's also a farmer and that. But he, I kind of wonder about, And I Love Her, he brings it into the guys and the kind of the relationship songs they've written are very, holding your hand, let's go out, please me. They're still, I think they're interesting relationship songs, even though they're written from a male perspective. There's a lot of them that has a very interesting statement to make. But "And I Love Her," as you say, is essentially him trying to do a "Till There Was You" type song, a slow, sincere, very direct type of love song. And I wonder, did he have any kind of doubt in his mind when he's bringing this in to his three sarcastic mates in Abbey Road?
Is he going to be? Well, it's interesting that at this time he brings it in, or their initial treatment of it is very different from the way it ends up. So perhaps that's the way of easing it in. You know, initially they're doing it with electric guitars. You can't say that it's a rocked up arrangement, but it's not, it doesn't have the delicacy or the romanticism isn't there when he brings it in. So maybe it just took him a while to sidle up to the full.
Yeah, there's definitely a direct line from "And I Love Her" to "Yesterday." And, you know, when he, from what we know about the song, it's written in Jane Asher's parents' home in Wimpole Street in London in February of 64, because they had 2 days off between Paris and America. We think that's when he wrote it. So what do you do?
That's nuts. I mean, like, that's absolutely nuts.
Whatever you do, don't sleep for 48 hours. Just write another song.
We've been in America. We're going to go to Paris and play this big string of dates. I'll just write another song. That's
And there's some quotes from Paul here where he says, you know, "I wrote it on my own. I can see Margaret Asher's upstairs drawing room. I can remember playing it there. It was the first ballad I impressed myself with. It's got nice chords in it, brighter the stars that shine, darker the sky. It was a love song, really. The "and" in the title was an important thing. And I love her. It came right out of left field. You were right up to speed the minute you heard it." And I'm assuming when he describes it like that, that, you know, it was just automatic writing, that it just sort of came out. And, you know, the thing that, you know, he will show again and again is recognizing the good idea and keeping it.
Yes. Yes, I think that's exactly right. And again, it's this point, you compare this with the lyric to "Can't Buy Me Love," where we're still buying people diamond rings and things. Yeah. This is a very grown up song. It's a much more mature, and there is that kind of, "Oh yes, and by the way, I love her." You know, it's a kind of a side. It's very cleverly done.
But as you say, you know, when it rocks up into the studio, it's not exactly the way we know it. And there is a, you know, very interesting early take on "Anthology" again, which is more guitar-y. It doesn't have the four-note refrain, which we'll come back to in a second. And it doesn't have the middle eight. It just has the repeating verses. And there's a, you know, this is another version of the studio is where things get knocked into shape, because he doesn't arrive with that middle eight.
No. Now, Paul will say in many years from now, he says, you know, "I'm not sure if John worked on that at all. The middle eight is mine. I would say that he maybe helped with the middle eight, but he can't say it's mine. I wrote this on my own." So he's very adamant that, you know, there might have been some input, but he is the one that's doing this. But there are other witnesses to the event that would attest to the fact that John really was pitching in with the middle eight.
Well, Dick James tells the story, doesn't he, that they're doing this early version, and there's kind of a realization that there's something missing.
Yes, Dick James is in the studio, it's interesting because he places himself right in the middle of this. But he says, he recounts, "George Martin told the boys, both Dick and I feel the song is just lacking in the middle. It's too repetitive and needs something to break it up." So it's
very Dick James's instructions.
Very specific. And then he says, "I think it was John who shouted, 'Okay, let's have a tea break.' And John and Paul went to the piano. And while Mal Evans was getting the tea and sandwiches, they just collaborated on the middle eight." So he's very clear that
it's all John because of and Paul Dick James.
It's all because of Dick James. That it would have been a terrible song if he hadn't pointed out that it needed some pepping up a bit.
Well, yeah, Dick James, he continues to give. But, you know, the middle eight is actually a middle four. It's only a four bar. So we're talking about the bit, "Because a love like ours will never die." That is the bit that they add. And that does make the song better. And then there's one other bit that makes the song better, wouldn't you say?
I would say there's a bit that just lifts the entire song.
And what bit are we talking about?
That would be the little four-note refrain.
So the four-note refrain that opens the song, do-do-do-do, as we know.
It was like having Paul in the studio.
There you go. But it wasn't Paul who did it in the studio, was it?
It wasn't Paul. No, it wasn't Paul. So, yeah, this is the thing that George comes up with this little riff. So, and Paul is quite open about this. I mean, he talks about this in the Scorsese documentary. And he said, oh, yeah, you know, Paul, I came in with the song and George came up with the riff. And he says, really, that's what makes the song. That's what you remember. That's the hook.
Yeah.
So, of course, it became a McCartney Harrison song and George got half the royalties.
That's not how music works, Stephen. You're very naive. That's the music business.
But John got half the royalties, did he? Oh, I see. Yeah, but
well, you know, his job was to, you know, arrange guitar parts for the, you know, that's why, you know, Stuart Copeland in The Police, you know, he didn't write the guitar figure for I'll Be Watching You, whatever that song was called, Every Step You Take. I think we've talked about this before, that got sampled.
We did, except when you talked about it before, it wasn't Stuart Copeland, it was Andy Summers.
Stuart Copeland's the drummer. I am not a big Police head. But yeah, Andy Summers plays guitar figure. It got sampled and Sting got all the royalties from Puff Daddy. They had to have a discussion after that. You know, but I think, you know, modern day songwriting royalties are maybe a lot more clear cut, which is why we've got hundreds of people on songwriting royalties these days. But yeah, George does write that little riff. And, you know, this song comes together in the studio from having no middle eight, no introduction, no form.
Yes.
You know, it becomes a different thing. And, you know, there's some overdubs and changes that happen later when, you know, Ringo puts on his percussion as well, which makes a difference. So everybody is starting to think differently.
Everybody's entitled to royalties here. Yes, it's a collaborative effort. And as you say, it's back to this point that we're saying the studio is, they're using studio time. Whereas before they would just kind of go in, knock out a couple of takes of the song, go back up the road to do another concert. Here, they're actually working things out in the studio in a way that they haven't done before.
But yeah, we talk about them using studio time, but yet they're still getting four songs done in a
day. I mean, it's very efficient use of studio time.
It is very efficient. Just to stick with And I Love Her, there's a couple of odd things. Obviously, Paul has played it live a lot over the years. It has been on many of his tours, and the Beatles themselves performed it live on their radio sessions and on the variety show Blackpool Night Out as well. And you've heard it live, haven't you?
I've heard it live. The first I saw Paul McCartney in Dublin, and I was there with a couple of people, one of whom I will not name, but she was a big Paul McCartney fan back in the day, and that was her favorite song. And I knew this was in the set list, and we were in the balcony, and we all but had to restrain her from jumping off the balcony. When this song,
it was really quite
dramatic, the effect of this song. That this song had. Yeah.
It's like that bloke in, Good Evening New York City, the guy who's crying during All My Love.
It was exactly like that. There was just kind of this emotional thing. But can I also mention the kind of weird German version of this song?
Yeah. There's lots of weird German edits that pop up from time to time.
Yeah, there's a German album called Something New, or the German version of the album Something New contains a stereo version with six guitar riffs at the end instead of four. Back in the day, I had an Odeon label release of a Dutch greatest hits album, and this was on it, and it's incredibly disconcerting because you sort of assume the song is going to end, you know the song well, four is the logical number, and then you just get these extra, which must have been inserted. It must be a special edit, but I haven't been able to find anything out about that or why it was done.
I'm not an expert by any means about all these kind of slight variants from around the world, but there's also the All My Lovin' version with the hi-hat intro, which is always a bit strange as well to hear.
Yes.
There's a guy on YouTube called Parlogram Auctions who breaks these things down very spectacularly, and is if you really want to roll your sleeves up and you know, if you think we're nerdy.
Yeah,
but he's got a fantastic amount of information. He does go into all these different German pressings. February the 25th, you know, as we said, George's birthday, and he's already given Paul the gift of that four-note guitar riff on his birthday. There's still more work to be done. There's one more song, which is, again, another not at all bad song, which is I Should Have Known Better.
Yeah.
And this we think is, you know, when they're in Paris, you know, the previous month, they're listening to Bob Dylan. And this might be the first song that's touched by the vibes the hand of Dylan. Of
Bob. Yeah. The hand of Bob. Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. So John talked very openly at the time about the fact that this is what they were listening to. Was he making a joke when he said we all went potty on Dylan? Was that a pot reference there?
I'm projecting.
But yes, they were clearly under, and you know, Lennon perhaps more than most, although George is the biggest fan, perhaps. John, you know, gets out his harmonica again and adopts a more folk style of harmonica playing. He gets his little Dylan cap out and starts writing lyrics, which are more autobiographical.
Mm. Yeah. The thing I would say about I Should Have Known Better is the harmonica is broken out. And in 1963, the harmonica is a certain type of Beatles sound. And it doesn't sound that way on I Should Have Known Better. It's a different type of harmonica. It definitely feels more Dylan-y.
It is. I mean, you know, that we the touched on this in the From Me to You episode, where the harmonica is the consistent kind of signature sound from Love Me Do and Please Please Me album and From Me to You. But those are sort of blues based style. We talked about Delbert McClinton and the Bruce Chanel cover that John was sort of Hey Baby, and that's the sound of bluesy style. This is a more kind of folk style, a more kind of wheezy folk style. It's not an attempt to return to that early harmonica sound or to carry that theme through.
And it's a song that takes a lot of work and a lot of takes. So, you know, it doesn't get finished on February the 25th. So they're back in studio the next day, which happens to be February the 26th. And there's some mixing going on in the early part of the day. But then the second half of the day, they are working on these kind of refined remakes of I Should Have Known Better and I Love Her to try and get them down pat. And so that's what day two in the studio spent trying to get to final versions of those. I Should Have Known Better has this very, you know, I think it's an interesting, you know, very well-known Beatles song. To me, you know, my first Beatles tape that landed in my Walkman was Real Music, the classic 1982 compilation. And it plays
everybody
a big role.
Everybody should start there.
I think start with Real Music and then work forwards and backwards, depending on which songs you like. You know, I Should Have Known Better is on that compilation, and it's quite prominent in the top 10 smash Beatles movie medley, or wherever it was a top 10 smash of roughly the same time. So it kind of gets a second lease of life in the early 80s. But there's a ton of different edits, mixes, versions. There is an edit. Once you hear it in the song, you can't unhear it.
Yes. But I do wonder if this happens quite a lot with the songs that are being recorded for A Hard Day's Night. And part of the problem is they're recording for a UK album. They're recording for a United Artists soundtrack album. They know that Capitol will be putting out a record as well that will come after the soundtrack album. They're under pressure. They have to go off filming. So there seem to be a number of little kind of glitches in the mixes and things like that George Martin has to go back in and fix. So we mentioned the drum edit on Can't Buy Me Love. Here, there's a little gap in the harmonica playing that George Martin goes in and fixes by as you said, snipping a little bit out and pulling it back and plugging a gap. And what seems to happen, we'll sort of not go through all the detail, but what seems to happen is they do a mono mix like that. Then they come back to do the stereo mix and they forget about that. So they forget that there's a gap. So then you get the stereo version has this little gap, the mono mix doesn't. Then one goes off to America, then they do fold down mixes, and you end up with lots of different versions. Then you get onto the film itself, where they start using different versions again. And there's a kind of mix and match approach. So it's lots of these little glitches turn up. But of course, now in the 21st century, we have Giles Martin comes in and just smooths everything out. And everything has to be this nice, homogenous. There's only one version of every song. That's the mantra now.
You say that like it's a bad thing.
It is a bad thing. It is a bad thing.
It does get a live performance on the British tour in late 64. It gets some BBC appearances as well. It gets some television appearances. But it's a lot of these songs do get lots of live versions. Not all of them, but almost all of them have get trotted out live. If not on tour, but on performances.
Yeah, so frequently what happens is that they do one or two live performances on TV or on BBC Radio, and then that's it. And some of them stick, like Can't Buy Me Love, it's stick. But I should Have Known Better is one of those songs that I think it works really well in the film. But can I say it's a song I don't really love? Am I allowed to say that?
They're having great fun in the railway carriage. They're playing cards. George is meeting Patty.
That's what I'm saying. It works really well in the film, but I don't know whether it's the harmonica or whether it's the kind of slightly faux Dylan sound to it. It doesn't have very Beatles sound to it. Maybe that's it. I don't know. There's always something. It's not my favorite song in this album.
That's okay. That's allowed. So we're still looking at this block of recording time. They, after February 26th, February 27th, their third day in a row in the studio, they do a bit more work on And I Love Her. And then the next track is Tell Me Why, a totally John composition, very straightforward, jaunty.
I like this song.
Okay.
No?
Yeah,
it's
no,
better
I do
than
like
I
it.
Should I have known. I shouldn't, but yeah,
I wouldn't put it on above. I Should Have Known Better, but okay.
Wow.
It is.
That's
what
why
it is.
We work. So, that's why we work so well together. This is entirely a John song, and in 1980, where he was going through all the songs, he said, the film people needed another upbeat song, and I just knocked it off. It was like a black girl group, New York kind of song. So this seems to suggest that in the US, when they're busy trying to conquer America, there's somebody on the phone saying, we need more songs. And I think we can kind of identify I Should Have Known Better, Tell Me Why, and I'm Happy Just to Dance With You as maybe the songs that are written in New York.
Okay. And so Tell Me Why is, as we say, an upbeat song that, they're really trying to, they're now about 5 days away from, not even 5 days away, 3 days away from starting filming. So they need to know what it is that they are going to be putting into the film. So they go through about 8 takes on the day, and it's take 8 that is the one that they keep. And they get most of the song done before lunchtime on February 22nd.
Yeah, because what they're doing here is they're just playing live, they're singing live to get the basic track down. And then there seem to be vocal overdubs. And again, George Martin and his magic piano are back.
He's just, in he goes.
In he goes, in he goes.
Do you know what this needs, boys? Fuck George. A bit of piano. And it's actually, having said everything gets a live turn, the only time this really gets a live turn is when they're recording it for the movie. It doesn't actually get into any live set
list. They kind of mime it and again, in front of Phil Collins. So he's...
The gift that keeps on giving. So that's they go off for their lunch, and then there's one more song to do in the post-lunch session, which is a song that I very much like, but I don't think its author likes it a lot, which is If I Fell.
Yes, he seems to have this is one of those songs that John seems to be very ambivalent about, where he says, I have two sort of modes of writing, the one where I just kind of knock something off and the other one that has a sort of more depth to it. And he seems to regard this as just being a bit of kind of hack work or just something. Yeah, it's just a song, nothing much to it. But he does say... that in 1980, he said, this is my first attempt at a ballad proper. It was a precursor to In My Life. It shows that I wrote sentimental love ballads, silly love songs, way back then. So again, he's kind of almost get a sense he's maybe slightly embarrassed by it or something. It's
we should point out that silly love songs aside was Lennon's, not yours. That Lennon was using them.
I wasn't claiming authorship of that.
He says, like, when he's in his the depth of his cynicism, maybe in 1971, I'd have a separate songwriting John Lennon who wrote songs for that sort of meat market, and I don't consider them, the lyrics or anything, to have any depth at all. But you know, if you're watching this very tight timeline, you know, Paul has brought in "And I Love Her," and you know, I'm not saying "If I Fail" is a slower acoustic direct love song as well. So it's that odd Lennon and McCartney balance that this is what he is bringing as a love song at the time, you know, and even acknowledges that.
Yes, I was going to say, Paul talks about this in Many Years From Now, where he said, you know, he did have a warm side to him. He didn't like to show it in case he got rejected. And it's back to this point that you were saying about, you know, "And I Love Her." You know, was Paul embarrassed to bring that in? You have a sense that, you know, he was probably more open or more prepared to bring that in, and maybe the embarrassment is going to be more with John, because that's not what people expect of him.
Yeah.
But if you actually look at these, if you look at the lyrics of this song, it's sort of, you know, I'm about to give up one person and start a new relationship with somebody else, and what would happen if that happened? And it's a peculiar, the psychology of this. I know you don't want to get kind of too much wrapped up in the psychology of these things, but it's a peculiar dynamic in the song, I think.
Yeah, it's not maybe as clear cut as you might think. So they're recording this in the afternoon. Take 15 ends up being the one that they use. And a nice note is that, you know, the thing I like about the song is the harmonies within the song.
Yes.
And, you know, John and Paul are apparently on the one microphone doing harmonies in Abbey Road when this is going down.
Yeah. So that's a nice, it's a nice image. And it's that they felt that, again, that kind of eyeball to eyeball following each other in doing that. And people do remark on the harmonies, but there's a kind of tale to be told there as well.
Yes. Now
fix in the mix.
Because I'm a, you know, a cigar smoking Martian child, this song sounds perfect to me. I don't notice any mistakes or issues.
No.
If I Fail, no. Stephen, but you're going to correct me.
Well, when I was growing up, in the 20th century, before we'd reached Mars, the version that I grew up with, it's a very noticeable cracking in Paul's harmony. He kind of goes for a note and he just doesn't get it on the word "vain," you know, "be in vain," and his voice just misses it entirely. And that was in the mix that I heard. And again, we're back to this point that they fixed it in the mix.
So it was in the original stereo mix that they have this cracked George or Paul voice, original mono mix.
Not in the original mono mix. So what I was growing up with were the stereo versions in the kind of early 70s pressings of these albums. So they fixed it in the mono mix. But then when they came to do the stereo mix, they forgot, maybe. For some reason, they didn't do this. And they also, there's a difference between the mono and the stereo mix in that John's voice is double tracked all the way through in the stereo mix, whereas it's not double tracked at the start of the mono mix. So again, you've got these little variations creeping in.
So they've taken away, from the 2009 stereo remixes, you don't get Paul's cracked voice anymore.
Again, they've smoothed everything out and everything is officially perfect in Beatle world.
But maybe when we're buying the Hard Day's Night Super Deluxe box set, it'll be like, hey, here's the original, slightly crappy mix.
I really hope they do restore that. It was an officially released version, so why should they erase it from history? It's cancel culture.
That song, I think, is all about the harmony. Yeah, they say this was our close harmony period. We did a few songs. "This Boy, If I Fail," "Yes It Is," in the same vein, which were kind of like the Foremost. There they are getting mentioned again. An English vocal group, but not really. Yes.
Not really. They're a Liverpool group, but the song that I discovered recently is called Rosetta, from 1968. And Paul actually went in and played piano on it. And if you listen to it, it's so Paul. Vocally it sounds like Paul. The piano sounds like Paul, and it's somewhere between Honey Pie and You Give Me the Answer. You know, it's one of those songs. It's a lovely little song, and it could easily have been written by Paul and sung by Paul.
I'll check that. I recommend you
check that out. Yeah,
there's a couple of things that If I Fell remind me of. Like a while back, I was watching A Hard Day's Night because it was on the television. So you just have to leave it on. It pops up on BBC Four every now and then, and the If I Fell section came on. And, my good lady wife, who perhaps is a little bit tired of the Beatles, was watching this going, oh, my goodness, they were rather good. You know, that kind of section where the harmonies kick in and Lennon's kind of sauntering around with his guitar and, they're tripping over things. And it's all a bit, you know, Lennon's pulling faces in the background. If you look closely, it is wonderful. And there is a great version out there, which we mentioned when we had Robin Hitchcock on the show, which is you can find it on YouTube. Thank God for people filming with cameras at gigs, which is Robin Hitchcock, Nick Lowe and Elvis Costello doing If I Fell. And you kind of get to see them working on their version of the harmonies, which is nice. It isn't one of these songs that gets live takes. So it's performed on television. Again, Blackpool Night Out. It's, played at the Hollywood Bowl. It's played on BBC sessions. But it doesn't make it in set lists past 1964. Sure doesn't.
No, I mean, I think it surprises me that they did it live, because you think that must be a very difficult thing to reproduce, particularly over the sound of the jet engine screams, but to try and get those harmonies right.
Yeah, there is they do take a pass at 65 for the Hollywood Bowl, so it doesn't totally disappear until 65. So that's If I Fell, and that's the last song that they get down on February the 27th. They're not back into the studio till 2 days later on March 1st, but they don't have a day off on February the 28th. They're doing a BBC session because you just don't stop working when you're just in the Beatles. But it's as good as a break, and that's where we might take a break at the end of episode one of our two-part look at A Hard Day's Night. It's a busy, dense period of work. What do you think, folks? Is it one of your favorite albums? Do you like I Should Have Known Better? I know I do. But there's a lot going on, and there's still more to go on, isn't there, Stephen?
There is. More next week.
And more next week. So thank you for listening. Go back and have a listen to Hard Day's Night between our two parts of our episode here, and get in touch with us in the usual places. We've got our Twitter at Beatles Pod. We've got our Nothing Is Real Facebook group. The big net for all of these things is our website, nothingisrealpod.com, and you'll get all our playlists and ways to get in touch with us and information about past episodes there. But for now, I'm Jason Carty.
I'm Stephen Cockcroft.
And this has been Nothing Is Real. Thanks for listening.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Thanks for listening to Nothing Is Real. We hope you enjoyed today's episode, and if you did, why not become a member? You'll get access to ad-free content, bonus episodes, and so much more. Follow the link in the show notes, sign up on Acast Plus, or visit our website, nothingisrealpod.com.